think this is our last topic in Christian ethics, spectrum of things that we've looked at, and kind of fits right alongside with, we talked about the sexual ethic the last few weeks. And so this is not a huge study, it's maybe just a couple weeks, it just depends, but so we want to talk about what does the Bible say about, since we talked about sex, what about birth control, right? And there's a variety of positions on birth control. And so we'll look at kind of just the culture and where we're at now to kind of to introduce that, maybe some quick statistics and some different positions. And then we'll look at some arguments from two main camps. There's really kind of a spectrum. There's maybe four or five when I was kind of sorting through positions I would kind of summarize on. And we'll kind of talk about little nuanced differences between them. But in your notes, we kind of break it down into the position that is completely against birth control versus in a position that's unopposed to the birth control. And what's the scripture say in both cases, in both scenarios? Okay. So before we get into kind of the introduction, I did some statistics. I looked on the CDC's website. So they, from 2015 to 2017, statistic that I got was that women from ages 15 to 49 reported that about 65% used birth control during that time period. The four main methods that they used were sterilization, either the woman or the man, having surgical sterilization. The number two, so that was about 18%. Number two was a birth control pill. Number three was, what do those letters stand for? I also have to confess, I was asking Carissa, like, what is this thing, you know? So there may be some,
like a DPV or something like that?
It's, I wrote down LARC, which is some abbreviation for something.
There's a shot on the arm?
Maybe. I think that might be what it is.
Yeah.
And then the male condom was number four at like 9%. And the percentages by age when they looked at women who were in certain age ranges, what percent of the women in those age ranges were using some form of birth control? For teens, 15 to 19, it ranked at about 37%. In the 20s, it's about 62%. In the 30s, about 72%. And in the 40s, 74%. So it kind of went up with age from teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s.
That stands for long acting reversible contraceptive.
Okay, yeah. So like a hormonal something that can be implanted or a shot that can be taken that can last for a month or 3 months. That's right. And so that was kind of a broad category that can include several different, where it's implanted or it's a shot or something like that. Thank you. Is any of those stats surprise you, or does that seem normal? I mean, any guesses why you think the use goes up in age, right? It's the least in the teens, more in the 20s, more in the 30s, more in the 40s.
It's very normal.
Yeah.
They don't want to have kids anymore.
Right.
Yeah. They'll get more, like, smarter over time.
Right. Could be. So, in the introduction, I thought this was interesting. One of the biggest voices and biggest opponents of birth control would be the Catholic Church. And so there's kind of a brief, and if you're familiar with Catholics or come from a Catholic background, some of this may be familiar. But so if we go back to the very early church, there was kind of two main extremes in regards to sex. So one hand, there's this desire to avoid this promiscuity that the antinomians. So the antinomians was a group that believed that, the more sin, then the more of God's grace is displayed. And so, like, pleasure, just do whatever you want. God is a God of grace and he forgives. And the church was resistant to that, rightly so, to try and resist this pursue pleasure at all costs. And but on the other hand, the Christians sensed that that complete abstinence that this Gnostic group was in favor of, just no sex at all, ever, even among married. So that was a very hard extreme on the other hand, because they viewed sex as inherently sinful, that this pleasure of the body was, that's a sinful act, and that man and woman was purely spiritual. So that was the Gnostic view, kind of clear over here. So you've got sex at all times, under any circumstances, no sex ever, under any circumstances. So that's the pretty broad extreme views there early on. So St. Augustine taught that while the fleshly pleasure of sex satisfied desire, the negative byproduct could be justified by this greater good of procreation. Okay, so in that train of thought, sex was okay as long as it was potentially creating children. Okay, because they believe, well, it does say, you know, be fruitful and multiply. So centuries later, St. Thomas Aquinas reaffirmed this disdain, but he didn't necessarily see the physical pleasure as morally reprehensible. So he affirmed that the primary purpose was for procreation. And so this kind of phrase that every sexual act had to allow for the potential to conceive, meaning that the view is then, as long as there's a potential that you're not doing anything to prevent the possibility of conception, then sex was permissible or it was acceptable according to that teaching. So therefore, right, even sexual union with one's pregnant wife was considered sinful because she's already pregnant, so there's no potentiality that you're going to become pregnant as a result of that. So you can kind of think about that. We'll talk about that in kind of some other scenarios as well. All right, so not much change. So this is, you know, over a couple thousand years. So about 1930, Pope Pius the 11th, I believe, published an encyclical which agreed with the previous injunctions against birth control. However, it did allow for sexual union and marriage where procreation was not possible. So previous to this, if it wasn't possible that a child would be conceived, then it was taught that it was sinful to engage in sex. So this allowed that, for example, if the wife was pregnant, just had become pregnant, you can still have sex with your wife. Even though you're not potentially creating a new life as a result of that. He accepts there that while the primary purpose of sex is procreation, there exists a secondary purpose in the abatement of lust and fostering mutual love. And then in 1932, I don't know if that's Nauss, I'm not sure, didn't get the pronunciation, published a theory which provided for the basis of the rhythm method. It taught that women were only capable of conception during certain times of the month. Consequently, with a little planning and a brief period of abstinence, a couple could avoid conception. That's kind of two keywords there. They could avoid conception. After much thought and investigation, the rhythm method was endorsed by the Catholic Church. I guess the question here, right? So what all through the times, right, what were some of the main reasons that they opposed birth control? That's kind of the heart of the reason.
Got in the way of having kids.
Right. It allowed you to have sex without worrying about it.
Yeah. And you're saying that's why they would oppose birth control?
Yeah. Because you could just, whenever you want,
okay,
have sex.
Yeah, so that we'll talk about how that, the idea that it encourages promiscuity, right? That you'd have sex more often if you didn't have to worry about kids. Okay.
That procreation was the purpose.
Yeah, that's kind of the underlying thing, right? That the purpose of sex is procreation. So if you're not procreating, then you're misusing or not accurately or properly. And then you can see they kind of, in the last century here, seems like acknowledge there might be another secondary or an additional purpose. And that's where kind of, if you were here the last couple of weeks when we talked about the purpose of sex, why God created sex within marriage, we'll kind of go back and review a couple of those things. Right. And so what do you think about kind of that last part it talks about in since the 30s that consequently, with a little planning and brief period of abstinence, a couple could avoid conception. So how is that consistent with their view, and do you see any inconsistencies?
It's a shift from the goal being procreation to the goal being, well, just don't, you know, like, don't do anything to abort a baby, basically. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
like you can avoid procreation.
But you can also plan for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the sense of, like, knowing when.
Yeah.
Well, it also encourages sex as pleasure instead of, before they didn't see it as pleasure at all. And now they're saying, well, if you do it now, it's, there's no reason, or there's pleasure involved. It's not just to make kids.
Yeah, and I think that the, like earlier, just a couple years earlier, that one when they said it's allowed in a sexual union where procreation wasn't possible. So, you know, it's almost like as long as you are procreating, then it's okay to have sex during the times when you're not most. And then I think one thing where there may be a slight consistency in the sense that, you know, in order to avoid conception, they're choosing at certain times to avoid sex. So what they're still trying to do is to link, right, that if you're going to have sex, then it needs to allow procreation. So if you don't want to have children at a certain time, then you need to avoid sex during those times when you might procreate. So they still see it as sinful to try and separate the sexual act and the potential for procreation. See how that's... It's not that there's no view that says, you know, that you can continue to have sex at any time and eliminate the possibility for procreation, although they do make allowances. So it's starting to kind of like brings out this question of why, right? What does the scripture say? Why should we have this view? Okay, so let's jump in. And now I'm not going to spend too much time, so... The question is obviously when we say what does the Bible say about using birth control? We'll briefly describe what we mean by what do we mean by birth control. So we've got it broken down into three kind of general categories. So you've got birth control methods which do not cause abortion. Right? So these are several of these, say 2, 3, or say 3, 4, 5, and 6. Would fit into like what you would call a barrier method, where we're preventing the sperm and the egg from ever coming into contact and ever the egg ever being fertilized by the sperm. So the idea there is that if you prevent that, any sort of fertilization, then there's never any life created that's going to be aborted. And then you also have periodic abstinence. And you've got the surgical, either tubal ligation or vasectomy. And all have the same kind of in common thing, that so long as we don't ever end up creating life or conceiving a fertilized egg, then it's not. We're preventing the possibility that we could be aborting or ending the life of the conceived. You guys can read through mine. That was my homework. I was like, okay, what's this one? What's that? Okay, and then so you got birth control methods which can cause abortion. So when we say it can, what we're saying here is not necessarily that that's the method in which they're intended to be used. Okay, that's not what we're saying. So, for example, this copper T IUD, a small copper-contained device that's shaped in the form of a T placed inside the uterus by a healthcare provider. The copper arms prevent fertilization by keeping sperm from entering the fallopian tubes. If fertilization does occur, the IUD would prevent the fertilized egg from implanting in the lining of the uterus. So what this is saying is that the means by which it's trying to prevent the fertilization, like the goal of it, and if it's successful, is that it always prevents the egg from being fertilized. But If an egg does happen to be fertilized, this IUD would prevent it from being implanted, and that would be what we would consider the fertilized egg would then, you know, be aborted. It would never have the chance to implant. So that's kind of the dividing line for these methods, is that it's medical professionals would say that it's possible that an egg will still get fertilized but never implant. And so that would be I thought it was interesting because when I talked to Carissa about, and you know, conversations she had with her doctor, some of these that say they can cause an abortion, she said, no, they never said that this could ever potentially do that. And so just doing a little more research, I found that there are some medical professionals that only define conception as a fertilized egg that has been implanted. And so that's a distinction, that if you only define conception as a fertilized egg that has been implanted, many of these won't cause an abortion, because once it's implanted, these will not keep them from growing. But if you have a fertilized egg that you do stop from being implanted, there's not necessarily a consistent message being given forth about whether or not that was conception or not. Some would say as soon as the egg is fertilized, it's conceived. Others say, well, if it's fertilized and implants, then it's conceived. Comments, what do you think?
Life begins at conception.
And conception is, right? So
fertilized egg.
Right? So the man and the woman have come together, and we know from like our microscopic study that, right, that's the fusing of the DNA.
Scientifically, there's evidence like we're growing animals outside of a womb, so it becomes a new being at that point.
Right. So you have the evidence that says it doesn't necessarily have to have the implantation to grow to be a full. And yeah, and I wasn't aware. Like I thought the different names, like the morning after and the emergency contraception, I thought those were always intended to take any eggs that had been fertilized and abort them, but I think the message is that it's intended to prevent fertilization primarily, but also not allow any eggs to implant as well. Okay? And you know, talking to, and again, you guys may know, I asked Chris, well, you know, are these ones that you've heard of? Do people use these? And she said that one of the ones that's more popular is the kind of the implantable, because it's like, I think she said several years that it will last, and you don't have to get a shot, you don't have to take a pill, it's just you don't worry about it. And then but it's also reversible, so you can always, you know, choose to get off of it if you want, have children later. Okay, so then birth control methods, which might be able, okay? So this is where, what we're saying, right? I'm not the medical doctor, right? So this is where we're kind of saying that we have a little bit of uncertainty brought into play. Right? So I'll kind of talk page 3. So within the pro-life community, there's debate about methods of birth control listed below. All of them function basically the same way. So they inject into the woman by a variety of different means, two hormones, estrogen and progestin. And they work to, number one, prevent ovulation. Number two, thicken the mucus lining to prevent fertilization. And three, make the uterus unsuitable for implantation, parentheses, at least in theory. So the last point of these three is where the differences are, right? So everyone agrees that if it does number one and does number two, that's not an abortive birth control method. It's preventing fertilization. But whether or not they work to do number three is what we've talked about. So does this method prevent a fertilized egg from attaching to the uterus? That's where there's some disagreement. So The first two methods, like I said, are clearly contraceptive, but the third, if it happens, is not. And so one place you can go to do some research, American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians. So you'll find two different position papers on the subject. One believes that the birth control pills are abortifacient, and the other believes that while the condition of the uterus is altered, it does not prevent an implantation. So, you know, I haven't read both the papers yet. So Randy Alcorn is one person who, in his research, came up with the conclusion that the birth control pill does cause abortion, which is something he and his wife had used. But they've, you know, based on their research, they believe that it could cause, it's possible it could cause an abortion. Okay. So the point here is that you're kind of in two places there, right? You can do the research and come to a conclusion based on the information, or you can kind of be in this unknown, like there might be some doubt because the professionals don't really have a consistent message. And so the question is, like, if there is a chance that it could do that, right, what would be our conclusion? What would be the right conclusion to do? If you knew that there's a 1% chance that your chosen birth control method could abort a fertilized egg, what should you do? And I don't know, I was telling Chris, should I do full disclosure? Like, we used the birth control pill for a long time, and there's tons of things that, you know, we go through the study and we're like, oh, I didn't know this, right? So a lot of times when we talk about ethics in here, we're coming to things somewhat learning. You know, it's like this when we talked about divorce and we talked about a lot of other things. And so I think that we want to remember that God's grace allows us to just openly say, well, I might have been wrong about something in the past. So
well, if we believe that's a person or a new being, it's like saying, would I go and do this activity if there's a 1% chance that my daughter Piper might die. Yeah. We're trying to separate, our society's trying to separate mm-hmm. the fact that that's like a person. You know?
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of grief for women in particular, I think, that if they did use the birth control pill, thinking that they were going to wait on their family and all those
mm-hmm.
things, and then discover that they can't have children,
mm-hmm.
and they realize what they did.
Mm-hmm.
It's devastating to some women. So, and men too, but I think, and
mm-hmm.
they didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's hard
mm-hmm.
to think about those children who could have. So.
I think what you're mentioning, it seems like there's a grief in the loss and also the feeling of the responsibility that it was a choice,
yeah.
right? And I think, like, with your message, we might, you know, if we do something that has a risk of, you know, the loss of the life of our children, and this is even more than that, where it's like you're potentially being the cause of the, not necessarily that you did something that was involved risk, it's that I'm taking an action. And that might be the direct cause versus we're going to do something to the family and it's somewhat risky and we could die from some other third cause even though I'm seeking out something. In this case, it's we're the one that's directly, so it's even more kind of personal.
It appeared to have been for selfish reasons. So then
mm-hmm.
a lot of guilt there.
Mm-hmm.
How does it muddy the waters when, like, okay, so sometimes the bill can be used for other medical purposes, like,
yeah.
not intending to prevent pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we're kind of getting into kind of the heart of the discussion is, like, is there ever times to use birth control? And if there is a time, like, what methods are can and should be used? But, like, are you talking about, I was trying to think of some other examples, like when they may take the pill, not necessarily for...
Like, it's frequently used to help manage symptoms of polycystic ovarian syndrome.
To, like, kind of regulate the hormonal...
it's complicated.
Yeah, okay. So there's some different uses. Yeah, it definitely muddies it a little bit. And so I think for us, you know, we're trying to take these complicated medical hormonal devices and try and figure out what actually is kind of going on so that we can distill whether or not that's something that fits in with the God's design. And I think you bring up a good point. So we're going to talk about how medicine in general, and like how is that, how are we to view that in terms of what is natural for the way God intended our bodies to work. You know, when do we take chemotherapy, right? That's not a natural thing to do to your body, but it's a use of medicine that God has allowed us to develop to accomplish, you know, healing, or which heals through killing, right? So it's kind of we'll have to think about, like, at what part is using the technology furthering God's kingdom or allowing us to kind of fulfill God's kingdom. So, there's a good verse here, Romans 14:5. One man regards one day above another. Another regards every day alike. Let each man be fully convinced in his own mind. In essence, we need to make sure that what we're doing is done with a clear conscience. And that if we're convicted that there is a risk that we may be causing an abortion, then we ought not to do it. Okay? And so we need to make sure that we're following our conscience in our actions.
So just to be clear, in case someone in this room is using it,
mm-hmm.
I think it's one of those things where it's like, it would be wrong for me to do it because I'm convinced it's wrong, but I can't say it's wrong for them to do it.
I believe so, because in that, what we see is that there are many Christian doctors who don't believe that the pill has this potential to take place. And so if you're going to go with and read the research and the papers and based on the differing opinions conclude that this seems to be very clearly, you know, not taking that risk, then that would be acceptable for that person, you know, in their conscience.
The last church we came from, we went through this 5 years ago, and the elder there basically came to the conclusion that it was okay to take the pill, but it wasn't important. So it's, you know, people.
Mm-hmm. And I think, sides. And I think that, you know, a good thing, if they've come to that conclusion again, this verse and this guidance would be to say, you wouldn't want to say that it's acceptable for everyone, because if your conscience is telling you, what you see is telling you that you shouldn't, then it is sin for that person. So that's what that scripture in Romans is telling us, that when we disobey our conscience and what God has convicted us about right or wrong, that's sin for us, right? For the man that eats the meat that's sacrificed to the idols. One knows that it's not... He has the believer's freedom, but oftentimes he lays down that right when they're together to say. So even if you have a husband and a wife, right, where one's fully convinced that it's not, and one's fully convinced that it is abortive, then you're not going to, because it would cause the other one to stumble into sin, to disobey their conscience. Does that help? So I'm not giving this is the pulpit view of the pill here, but kind of giving you guys a little bit of homework, I guess, to look through. Okay. So, I was thinking about this, right, the two schools of Christian thought. So I thought, you know, you've got against and unopposed. But there's kind of some nuances in these a little bit too, in terms of application, because like, what do you define as birth control, in a sense of would you consider, you know, the rhythm or the family planning method as birth control? You're preventing conception and childbearing, but you're not interfering with the process of the sexual act. So you're allowing that possibility at every time. And I think we talked about, we've got the ancient, right? You got all sex is wrong. that was the Gnostics, right? And then you got kind of the early Catholic Church where really early they said because of procreation, right? They said it's acceptable only for procreation. So for example, if the wife is already pregnant, if she's not ovulating or menstruating, it's sinful. If she's menopausal, right, sinful. Only if it's possible that they could procreate. So you've got kind of some degrees here. And then kind of this unopposed as well, we've got what type of birth control method, whether it's just the barrier method is acceptable or barrier method plus the hormonal methods. But then you got all the way down here, you've got abortion, right? So we know this is sin, right? And so the question is, right, where is this line into which what's acceptable scripturally and what's... Does that kind of make sense? Right? Where does this line come into play? Is originally, like, this was sin right here, right? If you had any sex at all, then it's kind of changed over time. So that's, right, no method of birth control is allowed that either presents a barrier to fertilization or introduces hormones, versus other Christians believe that contraception may be used to limit the number of children born as long as the method is not abortifacient or something that causes an abortion. How are we doing on time?
Okay. Oh.
I was curious, I was trying to come up with some questions like if you guys were familiar with or come from churches, like you were mentioning, you were at one church where he said it was acceptable. Has anybody been in any background, Catholic or whatever, where it's more towards this end or never at any time? I know that we have some people in the church that come from Catholic.
I'd say like there's people in my extended family who definitely... a big topic, but like they view sex as a purpose, like to have kids rather than like that's the highest,
right?
That's the primary. So I feel like it depends on what your primary function of sex is.
Yeah.
So they would say if you're using birth control, then like you're robbing sex of its highest purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably not right. That's
mm-hmm.
what.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like
backgrounds. Yeah.
So it depends on your view, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily the person.
It does. So that's going to be one of the things that will kind of help define it, is like, what is the purpose of sex? Kind of helps you make the decision of whether or not birth control. Because before the kind of invention of birth control, right, there was this link that couldn't be separated, mm-hmm. that sex and procreation were linked together, and right, you knew that that was something that could happen when you had sex, much of the time. So the idea is that is it sinful to ever break that link between those two?
Yeah, because it is a fairly new idea, like 6,000 years without it or whatever, 7,000. So like, this is a fairly new idea that.
Yeah, this preventing conception is, but like thousands of years, the mothers have been aborting by various ways, right? Just kind of in my research, even back before Jesus' time, that was a very common practice in the Roman Empire. Part of it wasn't; it was even part of even the some of the pagan idol worship, is not just sacrificing animals, but sacrificing children. So, very different, but at the same time, I was just struck by, you think about abortion today and comments about how there's a historian that wrote about how, in the Roman Empire, the mother and father might sacrifice an infant, no tears shed, slit its throat. It was just gruesome. And the hardness kind of the heart. And so it's very sobering, right, to think about. So I thought what we do is we talk about some of the ideas behind the first position against contraception, and then some of the ideas behind the unopposed, and look at scripture and see like what does scripture say, give you guys a chance to dialogue about it. So the first and most, foundational one we should look at would be, comes after kind of, well, some people say natural law, right, that everything kind of has a final cause, like what is this supposed to be the cause? So when we look at the sexual organs, their design, the uterus, the sperm, right, we see that their final cause is the procreation of human beings, and God created sex for the purpose of procreation. So, if we follow that logic, we should abstain from contraceptives because, kind of like what you're saying, you're limiting or removing the whole purpose of the sex to begin with. Okay? So that's a powerful one. And then if we look at scriptural arguments, we've got Genesis 1:28. Does somebody want to read that for us?
God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth.
Okay, so what is it about that scripture that someone might say? If you look at the scripture, right, that would tend to prohibit contraception.
Well, it almost sounds like a command, like to be fruitful.
It does sound like a command. Yeah, it does. What's the command, right? What is it commanding us to?
To be fruitful and multiply.
All right, be fruitful and multiply. And what else?
And fill the earth.
Fill the earth. One more.
Subdue it.
Subdue it. And one more.
And rule.
Rule, right. A lot of command. You have five commands there, right? Fruitful, multiply, fill, subdue, rule.
And so by using any type of contraceptive, it's not fulfilling that command. Or
right.
Not
so you
obeying
could,
that command.
Yes. So you could argue that if we use contraception, we are not being fruitful and we're not multiplying.
This also like comes right after God creates. Like this is the first thing he tells. One of the very first things he tells Adam, right? He doesn't give him a bunch of other commands.
Right.
First.
This is number one.
Yeah. So it's kind of a powerful message,
mm-hmm.
right?
What's the first thing you're commanded to do? And fill and subdue and rule. So, what's kind of the picture? Like, why? I guess maybe it's deeper. Why are we to be fruitful? Why are we to multiply? Why are we to rule? What is that accomplishing?
But it says he said to them.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily mean he said that to us.
You mean saying it to Adam and
to
Eve?
To them, yeah. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they had to because there was nobody else. He wanted to.
I see what you're saying.
But he's not saying all mankind do these things.
It's a good question. Yeah. So is this command applied to every individual that's ever lived? It's a question we'll talk about in a bit.
Earlier, after he in chapter verse 21 and 22,
mm-hmm.
he creates like all living creatures,
mm-hmm.
and then in 22 he says, "Be fruitful and multiply."
Mm-hmm.
So even animals, like it's like God created the world and he wants it not empty but like filled. So that's why I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's also part of it. Like,
isn't it also repeated after the flood?
Mm-hmm. Yep. We do see that same command is given to Noah later in Genesis. And again, what's kind of similar between the creation scene and
there
after
were very
the flood?
Few people and animals.
Either two or eight people.
Yeah.
And so the question comes up that we have to answer, like, is the world ever filled? Is it ever subdued? Do we ever reach a point? Right? So if it's not ever filled, then it would apply, it would be a kind of an ongoing command.
And some people argue right now that the earth is overpopulated. Trying to feed everybody
mm-hmm.
and everything has become
mm-hmm.
an issue. So whether you believe that or not. Just,
right.
But
right.
There's an argument for that. So.
Yeah. So we'll dig into the verse a little bit more as we go when we come into like... So what we're going to do is we're kind of look at a lot of the verses and say, this is how it might be used. And then we'd say, is there a biblical answer to that that would maybe balance out that view, right? But the point is that it does point to God's command to be fruitful and to multiply. And so there seems to make sense that that would be prohibiting, you know, going against that command to not be fruitful and not to multiply. See a lot of people?
Just drove through from like Colorado to here. There's like nobody.
Yeah. Yeah.
500 miles.
Yeah, you got room, right?
So I'm
in some countries, it's actually the population is declining because they aren't having kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like Japan, I think, declining.
Yeah, it definitely depends upon where you look, right? You could make a very strong case to say, you know, look at this, you know, there's millions, you know, square miles. And then you might go to India or somewhere and like, there's a billion people and there's, you know, so, you know, that's, or you could look at like a super crowded place like Times Square versus a super, you know, like the dumps where people are not trying to live because there's no shelter, no food. And so like, there's a lot of ways we can kind of have this almost an emotional attachment to one of these pictures without kind of thinking about the world as a whole and the balance of that. Okay, let's see. Let's look at one more passage before we go. This is a great one. Does anyone want to read Genesis 38, 6 through 10? Bonus pastor points from Dave. This is about, who is this guy? Onan, I think. Not Onan the Barbarian. This is just Onan. So, this is from Genesis. Now, Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for her." Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also.
I heard this one used a lot.
Yeah?
And I think that, I mean, it's one of those things where Onan, we wouldn't do that today. Onan would not, that would be considered,
right,
like in New Testament terminology, a brother-in-law,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
sleeping with his brother's wife would be considered adultery.
Well, it's remember that died, right? So she's not married anymore. But this is a particular application, you're right, this of the Old Testament law. So let's look at you guys flip to Deuteronomy 25, right? Because it says here in the middle, perform your duty as a brother-in-law. So Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10, to try and understand kind of the context of what's going on here.
What I'm kind of asking is whether or not, I mean, the entire passage is prescribed for New Testament purposes.
Right, right. So right now, one good thing you're bringing up is that this is a descriptive passage. It's not a prescriptive. It's describing something that happened. And so we do need to be careful to remember that you need to be very cautious in trying to draw a command out of a descriptive, right? So we see many things done and described by David or by Abraham that we would not call a prescription, taking of other wives, etc. Right? So that's a good point. All right. So that's one thing to be cautious about. What's going on here is Deuteronomy 25, 5 to 10. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as a wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, so that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, Then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, and if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. What an insult. All right, so why was it so important that she have an heir? To take care of her is one thing. There's something even more that has a lot more to do with Ur and Onan.
The family line.
The family line. And what's something that they, kind of hinting, what's something that they pass down through the family line? The land, right? So the father here is Judah, right? And so each heir kind of inherits part of the land. Right now, who is the oldest in this story? Is Kesta?
Ur.
He's the oldest, which means he gets what for his inheritance? Double. Right, firstborn gets double. Now, if there's no firstborn, what happens to all that land? Does it get passed on to Ur? Does it get passed on to his wife? Right.
Taking Onan was second born, so
so yeah, there's a lot of things going on here where notice that, you know, Onan didn't refuse to go into her, right? He went ahead and kind of acted like he was going to fulfill the duty, but he wanted to make sure that there was no heirs that were born. See that? He could have rightly done what's described in Leviticus or Deuteronomy 25 and said, I don't want to do this, right? And some other... if there was another brother, right? He could have publicly made that declaration as well. So there are lots of other things that when you look at what's going on here. But, like you bring out, this can be used as a reasoning behind why we might oppose. Why would this oppose? Because it says very plainly that he wasted his seed on the ground in order to not give offspring to his brother. What he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life. So obviously, whatever he did here and whatever his purposes were, it was very displeasing to the Lord.
Technically, he broke the law of the Deuteronomy commandment, the commandment that was brought up in Deuteronomy, or that, you know, command. It wasn't necessarily one of those things where, you know, let's say there's no biblical story of a married couple doing that where it was considered displeasing.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see.
Isn't this also before the law, though? Since the story is before the Israel law that God gave. Right?
Yeah, that's a good...
It's like if we're applying the New Testament covenant to the Old Testament, right? A little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And so it is kind of... it's. Because, like, when you look at this, it's almost as if that duty and that description of the law, specifically in Deuteronomy, is like explaining something that they've been practicing for some time, that we need an heir, we need someone to carry on the line, that type of thing. So it's a good point. And so understanding the... how those commands are given and for a purpose and at what time. It's kind of important. Okay, so we will, there's a couple other supports for why we would be against that we'll start with next time.